From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, the organization Youth Speaks turns 20 this year and reflects on two decades of teaching young people in the Bay Area and across the country the power of spoken word.
He sank to the bottom to raise me.
But something raised me. Palms on the soles of our feet. Ancestral ghosts wouldn't allow the sea to swallow us whole again.
In this hour of Forum, we'll hear spoken word performances and personal stories from two Bay Area Youth Speaks poets and talk with the group's founder, who had the idea of giving young people pens, a stage, and an outlet to declare who they are. We'll get started right after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, welcome to Forum's second hour. I'm Mina Kim. James Cass founded Youth Speaks 20 years ago while he was getting his master's in creative writing at San Francisco State University. He felt young people were being misunderstood and inaccurately portrayed in the media. The small writing workshop that began in the 90s is now a national program with more than 200,000 teens participating every year. Youth Speaks' big events here, the Teen Poetry Slam semifinals and Grand Slam final, are going on now to mid-April. And today we have the good fortune of having two Youth Speaks veterans with us to perform spoken word in this hour of Forum. And let me tell you who they are. Tamia Romo, she is a poet and member of Spokes, the student advisory board of Youth Speaks. Good morning, Tamia Romo.
Good morning.
And how old are you?
I'm 17.
17 years old. And so you are a mentor to a lot of folks who are in Youth Speaks.
I am one of the mentees. I'm getting mentored. I believe that I mean, everyone can be a mentor. So that's definitely a valuable insight.
Well, we're happy to have you here. We're also happy to have Gabriel Cortez. He's a poet mentor at Youth Speaks. Hi, Gabriel Cortez.
Hey, good morning.
Thanks for being here. And James Cass, of course, the founder and executive director of Youth Speaks. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
So, you know, Gabriel Cortez, let me start with you. When did you first get involved in Youth Speaks?
Oh, man. 8 years ago, in 2008, I was at the Brave New Voices International Youth Poetry Festival, where I was on a team representing Los Angeles. And it was the first time that I encountered Youth Speaks, and it was this huge, beautiful festival. And the introductory ceremony, I just remember seeing young folks from all over the states, all over the world, doing their introductory poems. And I remember just being so blown away and just being like, oh, this is it. These are my people. This is my family, you know, my community. And I've been involved since. Now I'm doing poet mentor work.
And what does that mean?
Yeah. So it means a few different things. Primarily, I'm making safe spaces for young folks to tell their stories, just facilitating writing workshops, whether it's in schools in collaboration with different teachers or after school at like the Berkeley Public Library every Thursday. I do a workshop for free. And
anyone can attend that?
Anyone that is 13 to 19 years old can attend that.
And Tamia Romo, how about you? When did you first get involved?
Well, Gabe briefly brought it up. I was first involved in one of the after-school programs where teachers and the mentors collaborate. And my mentor was Trey Amos, and he's absolutely amazing. He brought me in with open arms. I came in to the class, a little frazzled, small child, and he really set that safe space that Gabe was talking about of allowing me to speak up and speak about my personal experiences, which was incredible. So I also found my small little community and family.
So safe space, James Cass, what does that mean? How do you create that?
Well, for us, it's allowing young people to be who they are and really pushing them to be who they want to be. For us, you know, it really started when I was getting my MFA. It really was looking at how do you create a space in which young people can define their own identity and use the language that they're most comfortable with to do so, to not have to step out of their everyday self to be a writer, to be a poet, to break the boxes that other folks were putting them in around who their cultural and personal identity needed to be. So for us, a safe space is multiple things. I mean, there's some physical things around what a space looks like, but really mostly it's around giving young people the space to be who they are, to tell the stories that they need to tell, to figure out what is most urgently burning within them that they need to address, and giving them the tools to do so.
And you, as I mentioned in the introduction and you just touched on here, you were concerned about how youth were being misrepresented in the media or in popular culture. And that, did you have a certain connection to this? Because I heard you reference how you felt like Gen Xers, or, you know, when people put labels on generations, that it just really felt to you like a misnomer.
Yeah. I mean, I happened to be working part-time here at KQED back then, and it was the mid-90s.
Really?
Yeah, at the Center for Education and Lifelong Learning. And it was the mid-90s, and I was just watching how here in California, a couple things were happening. Like Prop 187 was happening. Prop 21 was sort of coming down the pipeline. There was the height of sort of hip-hop thuggery being portrayed in the media, right? It was the highlights of the Tupac Shakur, Biggie Smalls days. And at the same time, it was also the height of the young Britney Spears, right? So who was this super idealized, angelic, sexualized virgin, right? It was this weird thing. And so you had this these total misportrayals of young people in the media, and you had this vilification of young people, particularly young people of color. And at the same time, I was being labeled Gen Xers, as were my peers, and we were being told who we are, who we should be, what was good about us, what was bad about us. And then Gen Y was coming down the road, and what was good about them and what was bad about them. And I was just, where is the individuality in that? Where is the opportunity for the next generation to define itself?
Yeah. And it's interesting, you know, you talk about these portrayals. I read that you also, one of the challenges is also when you get the kids in your safe space to try to help them not feel pressure to, you know, follow through on that stereotype, to portray what they're seeing around them.
Yeah, you know, when we start a You Speaks workshop, and this is what I think Gabe and Tamia were both referencing, we have two rules. The first is there are no wrong answers, which doesn't mean there's not stuff that's factually incorrect. It just means it's not wrong to participate and speak up. And the standard is yourself. We're not asking you to sound like, look like, be like anyone else. We're asking you to find who it is you want to be, who you need to be. And so we start from those very basic principles. And for us, young people are, there's a mythification of who young people are. And we, you know, when I started the program, I would go to the public high schools in San Francisco. And the first thing I would say is, this was pre-internet for the most part. So I would say, when you turn on the television, when you go to a movie, when you open a magazine, and you see people that look like you, do you feel you're fairly portrayed? Do you see a representation of yourself? And none of them were like, yes, that's me. It was like, it kind of looks like me maybe, but for the most part, that's not me. And so it really started from that place.
Wow, that is so intense, Gabriel Cortez. I mean, did you feel to have to confront who you are and why you might be being somebody you're not? Did you feel like you had to go through that process?
Yeah, and I feel like I'm still going through that process, you know, every day. But one thing that I do remember that made that easy is getting to see that modeled. So going back to when I first encountered Youth Speaks, one of the first events I remember, there was a performance by a local poet named Rafael Casal, who did a poem called ADD, where he was talking about his nephew and the greater social context of, you know, what is attention deficit disorder, specifically in the United States. And I remember being in the crowd and just listening, right? We talk about the oral, like not only what we say, but also the act of sharing and listening to each other's stories. But I remember sitting in this huge audience with young folks I never met before, and it's the first time I cried from a poem, just seeing somebody get honest and to make that bridge between their personal story and something that maybe other folks in the room were experiencing too, right? So that's is one of the main ways that I've learned to start to confront who am I, really? How can I also tell stories that are true to my specific experience and make room by modeling that for other folks to do that as well?
And you brought a poem with you today. Do you want to say anything about it before you perform it for us?
Sure, sure. More than anything, I just want to give a few shout outs to folks. So it's a poem where I was trying to, and I'm still constantly doing this, trying to figure out what does it mean to be me? What does it mean specifically to be Afro-Latino? What does it mean to be son of immigrant mom growing up in my grandparents' house? And this is ultimately a poem for folks whose parents weren't born here, who maybe has somebody in their family that has at least one gold tooth. So that's
and that's the title, huh?
It's called Gold Tooth. So can I go ahead?
Yeah.
All right. Some couples wear matching clothes. My grandparents had matching gold teeth. 14-karat gold with a star in the middle, so when they smiled or spoke, their gold teeth seemed to wave like two halves of the Panamanian flag blowing in the wind. My grandparents are Afro-Latino. You know this from the way their kinky hair stands at attention over the dark cocoa of their skin and the conjuring that happens whenever they open their mouths. Whether it's the way their Caribbean accents spill from their tongues like sliced mangoes and salsa, or the way gold flickers from between their thick moreno lips like a slow setting sun, my grandparents aren't from around here. But us Afro-Latinos been here since the start. In the Caribbean, where African slaves flowed easy as Spanish doubloons. Where they hacked our limbs like stalks of sugarcane, but couldn't make us forget how to run. In Panama, where our bodies lay buried beneath the canal like a mass grave in the U.S. Where we found ghetto, in military, in melting pot. Where elementary schools made our mothers wrench the accents out their mouths like pulling teeth because there is something especially dangerous about black folks that can talk smack in a language you can't understand. Whether it's Spanish, or French, or Yoruba, or the African dialect stripped from our memory, we have been here, always leaving pieces of ourselves behind. Toes and tendons buried beneath the sand every time we must uproot our legs and teach them to swim again. But we are adept at replacing the lost. Ain't that the blues? Ain't that cumbia and gumbo, voodoo, Santeria, hip-hop, and Negro spirituals, Creole, patois, and neighborhood slang? We steal from the master's kitchen, baptize it in grease and resurrected soul food like we raise a hoopty from the dead, sit it on rims and bump the bass till the plates fall off. Sometimes we even paint our missing teeth gold. We all try to fill gaps given to us. Even after immigration, addiction, and cancer left holes the size of grapefruits in their jaws, my grandparents still smile like pirates, gold shining between their lips like stars in the night sky, a checkerboard of ivory and gold. So every time I see an elder Afro-Latino with a mouth shining like the sun, I can't help but smile because I know they're healing one golden tooth at a time.
Wow. Wow.
Thank you.
That's Gold Tooth by Gabriel Cortez. How do you prepare to get up and deliver your poem, to perform your poem? What do you do when you're preparing to sort of speak truth?
Yeah. So before I get on stage, so I used to be an athlete in high school, so I kind of prepare the same way. I used to prepare before I do like a track meet. So I take laps. I run. Try to run around the room, try to get warm, try to make sure that all the chills out of my hands. And one thing I tell the young folks whenever they're feeling butterflies is like, take all those butterflies and find a way to convert it into dragon fire and just spit it. Just say it and just let it out, you know, like you practice, like you know how, you know.
And Gabriel, you're 25 now.
26. I just turned 26.
Whoa, happy
couple
birthday.
Weeks ago. Thank you.
And most of the youth that you mentor are how old?
So between
13 and 19.
13
right,
and 19.
Right.
So, I mean, I'll have sometimes eighth graders, sometimes all the way up to folks in their first year of college.
Yeah, I was just thinking about how young it is to, you know, how young folks are when they get up on stage. It's a lot. What was it like for you, Tamia Romo?
Oh, it was incredibly nerve-wracking at first, I think. But there is something so cathartic about finally being able to say something that you've been holding on to for so long. And my first experience was with TPS, with our Teen Poetry Slam, which was incredible. I got up and my legs were shaking and it was a preliminary bout. And finally, I was able to say these really kind of like at the time scary things for me. But being able to have that family immediately, have that sense of community immediately once I was saying all of what I was saying, like my poetry, and have the reaction from the crowd and have the crowd be like, that was incredible. I'm so proud of you. And have these strangers say that. It was amazing. It was really healing.
What was that you had held on to that you wanted to say?
It was, well, my poem at the time was about my relationship with my mother, which has always been pretty tumultuous. And it was sort of this, I forgive you and I forgive myself for our tense relationship. And I really didn't know how to say that to her, but I could say it to this crowd. And that was something that was still very valuable and still incredibly cathartic.
How has that changed you, do you think?
I think it has made me a lot more open-minded to other people's feelings, so a lot more empathetic. It has stretched my level of empathy. I now, when I'm thinking about other people's feelings and their stances and their beliefs and their ideologies, I take all of the possibilities into account. Their backgrounds, their experiences, everything.
Yeah. It's interesting, James Cass, listening to Tamia Romo, thinks about the role both of the person who's delivering the poem and also the audience that's listening to it. What do you tell the audience that they have a role in this?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for us, the audience is as important, if even not more important than the poets. And a lot of things happen. I mean, we hope that it's a generative process, right? I think one of the things that has been extraordinary for the last 20 years is right away from day one, the young poets on stage were never about, look at how fresh I am. Like, that was part of it. Like, the young people wanted to show, like, I'm fresh. But it was really about, let's have a conversation. And I want to be one voice of many. And that together we're going to create this moment of culture and we're going to generate. And, like, if there's a 10-year-old in the crowd and I'm 15, I want you to be on the stage in 5 years. And what I'm doing now is helping to set the stage for you. And I think that's been something that the young people came with on their own. Like, we push it a little bit, but young people really come to that. And, you know, something really interesting happens because you referenced it a little. I think sometimes we, the adults, we forget actually how young these young people are when they're on stage because some of the work is so profound and so complicated. And they perform it with such bravery and maturity. But I consistently have heard for 20 years, adults who come to their first You Speak show say two things. One is, I wasn't thinking about anything that deep when I was that age. And the other is, I leave tonight much more hopeful about the future of the country than I left coming in if I know the future of the country is in these young people's hands. And that, to me, is a pretty profound thing, right? It's Gabe referenced the orality of the work, right? So it's O-R-A-L, but also A-U-R-A-L, right? From the mouth to the ear. Mm-hmm. Like, the poet doesn't exist if there's no audience to engage with the work. And the audience doesn't exist if there's no one engaging with them. So it's, for us, it's a real true call and response.
So then, Tamia Romo, what does poetry mean to you?
It means having a platform in which you can create family and community, in which you can have this communal sense of healing. I think that, for me, that's probably my feelings right now for it. Every time there are poets or writers or just people who love to hear poetry around me, it's this tight-knit group of people, and we're all there to listen and to validate one each other and to reach self-actualization, which is so important.
Tamia Romo is a member of Youth Speaks. We're also talking with Gabriel Cortez, a youth mentor, a poet mentor for Youth Speaks, and James Cass, the founder of Youth Speaks. Tamia Romo, you brought a poem with you today. Do you want to tell us a little bit about it?
I will definitely tell you a little about it. It is titled A Eulogy. It is for Oakland and also for my cousin who recently passed away.
All right. Let's hear it.
Tonight in Oakland, the moon does not favor these shades of blasphemy. As a seas of men in white-collared suits come rolling in by the tides of her command, we begin to see our homes as ghosts, begin to dilute the dark soil in which we were all birthed tonight. Maria and her 5 children sleep in the black minivan they bought before the rent prices went up. She sings the songs her mother taught her in the motherland, Arruca, mis niños, ya no llores más. Sleep, my children, cry no more. But what happens when the Oakland streets swallow us whole and all we can do is cry? All we know is mourn. Like my Aunt Lavelle, whose husband is in prison and is now raising 4 sons ever since Torian got shot, body found on the floor outside the door of his home. How do I reconcile? The axe hatches this city has swung at my family tree and still be willing to birth new branches in all my kin's places. How do I hand my future to shaky, sweaty hands who seem to grow sicker and paler every day? And I cannot help but think, if I leave this home, how will I see her as anything but the one who got away, but my unrequited love? As I sing her a love song and she sings me the new indie track saying how now it's cool to look poor, but not be poor, love black culture, but not black people, how I should begin to say her name with past tense verbs, just like she has taught me to do with my family. I wear the title American, like the surname of an absentee father. He claims a bloodline, ignoring the blood spilled in his name, expects me to jump over these puddles of ripe boy after boy, claiming my people have crossed bodies of water filled with the bodies of people before. My Oakland is sometimes boiling, Sticky Hot Jazz, Overcast on Mountain View Cemetery, Mac Dre blasting in the halls of Oakland Tech, smelling of tacos, Mi Rancho, skies too short and blue, slipping into a sleeping sepia, a never-ending view of the world. Skyscrapers sticking out like we in the mouth of God, we birth gods in this city. Have you ever seen the gold of sun rays? Be threatened by so much bursting beautiful brown and blackness. But we also be frisked. Be gentrified. Be Rodney King by a history of rough riders. Be profiled in shrinkingly black neighborhoods. Be holding our tears like we hold our children. Be never broadcaster Amber Alerts while walking on international. Be untracked. Be in untracked classes. Be letting white people with dread say they're down for the movement. But we be strong. We be prideful. We be safe keepers of each other.
Thank you, Tamia Romo. That was Tamia Romo, 17-year-old poet with Youth Speaks. You're touching on a lot of really deep personal but also really contemporary issues. Can you talk a little bit about the process of writing this poem? How were you, you know, what was the first thing? What was the first step?
The first thing, I was thinking about my feelings towards Oakland. And at the moment, I was still doing the grieving process of losing a family member. And I think that had a huge influence on it. But there's also so much love for the city. As I say, like the sleeping sepia skies, there's something when it's 3 a.m. and you're in Oakland and the sky isn't really dark, but it's this kind of murky color because of all of the light pollution, but it's still so beautiful. And I think that's so indicative of my feelings towards Oakland. And it's changing. You can see it kind of being molded into something else, which is what I address in here, which is gentrification and all of those things. And it was an interesting process. I had never written about my hometown before. It wasn't something that I usually do. I usually do more sentiment, like more things about my feelings and my history, but kind of writing that was really surprising at what came out, and it helped me kind of cipher my own beliefs and my own feelings and what I can do to take action against the things that are happening, which is speaking about it.
Tamia Romo, she is a Youth Speaks poet. We're also joined by Gabriel Cortez, poet, mentor of Youth Speaks, and James Cass. He's founder and executive director of Youth Speaks, which is celebrating its 20-year anniversary. And right now it has its 2-month-long competition, which wraps up with the Grand Slam Finals at Davie Symphony Hall on April 16th. If you want to talk with these Youth Speaks poets, with James Cass, give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, that's 866-733-6786. Maybe you have some experience with Youth Speaks you want to share, or just some questions about getting involved with the program. Email us at KQED at forum@kqed.org. Post comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, or on Facebook or Twitter. We'll be back after the break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. 2 decades ago, San Francisco-based Youth Speaks held one of the country's first teen poetry slams, and it launched a nationwide youth poetry movement. And we're joined by the founder of Youth Speaks, James Cass, and also 2 Youth Speaks poets, Gabriel Cortez, a poet mentor with the organization, and Tamia Romo. She is with their spokes program, the Student Advisory Board of Youth Speaks. And we just heard a poem from Tamia Romo. James Cass, you wanted to say something.
Yeah, I really just love the moment that happened, because I think that speaks exactly to what it is we try to do as an organization. Because not only did we hear this incredible poem written by a 17-year-old that started in a workshop that she then finished at home, I imagine, and then it's multiple layers and talks very interestingly about this issue, and it's both personal and also sort of social in context, right? Because it talks about the city of Oakland, but it talks about her life and her family. But then, Tamia, your ability to talk about the larger context and the personal context in which you created the piece, too, is really key for us, because that's ultimately what the organization's about. It's about giving young people the opportunity to both investigate and explore and then demonstrate their expertise, their own personal expertise about their own lives, but also the expertise of the world in which they're growing. And, you know, Tamia talked earlier about the move to self-actualization, and we look at that both on the individual level, but also on the cultural and social level. And our hope is that by empowering enough young people and giving enough young people the space to find and develop their voice and then present those voices publicly, that we can actually help change conversations, change perceptions of young people, and actually on a grander scale in the aggregate, what happens when tens of thousands of young people find the power of their voice and are able to articulate and demonstrate their own lives on their own terms and do so in a context that's not just about me and my own stuff, but it's me and my relationship to the world as it's moving.
Alan writes, I wrote my first poem when I was 12, but didn't get started until I was 16, at which age I joined the Alameda Poets. I was influenced by Tolkien, Beowulf, and a number of other sources. I now have a Facebook friend from Italy who likes some of my work online somewhere and sent me a friend request.
Nice.
And you've talked a little bit, James Cass, about the growth of this internationally. Can you just quickly share with us, the trajectory from Youth Speaks in the Bay Area to this global now phenomenon of the Poetry Slam and also the HBO series Brave New Voice. I mean, there's just been a lot that's developed around your program.
Yeah, I mean, so quite literally, I started the program here in San Francisco, and we started in the public high schools of San Francisco. And then we did that first Poetry Slam in April of 1997, and young people from throughout the Bay Area came. We got a great article in the Chronicle about it. But I saw from that very first event that a true pretty good representation of the future demographics of the Bay Area participated. And so we started to expand our programs throughout the Bay Area. And at the same time, I got in touch with somebody in Connecticut who was doing something similar, just getting it off the ground. And so we started working together to plan the first national teen poetry slam, which is what it was called then. Now it's called Brave New Voices. It just so happens, too, that my brother was a public high school teacher in the Bay Area, and a woman who was working here as part of the old San Francisco Bay Area Book Festival. They both moved in 1999. So she moved to New York, my brother moved to Ann Arbor, and they took the program with them. So that was where we first started having chapters, a chapter in New York and a chapter in Ann Arbor. And we did the first festival. We actually did a documentary on PBS called Poetic License. And the next year, we had 14 groups. And then 10 years later, we did the HBO show. And now we have, 100 organizations sort of across the country, pretty much in, I think, 46 different states, pretty much every major city, plus rural areas, Native American reservations, border towns north and south, Hawaii, Alaska, Guam. And in fact, our Grand Slam finals are this April 16th. And after the finals, we have people who are coming from the Netherlands, from the UK, from South Africa, and from Belgium who are coming to get trained in our methodology to help build programs back at home. So it truly is this moment and this movement that continues to grow about young people, not only having the inherent desire to express themselves, but having a desire to be heard and also to listen, which is also the key thing, right? It's like, how do we, we think about what's going on in different parts of the world. And so much of it is about people not having an opportunity to speak for themselves, to speak on their own terms. And so they're rebelling against and reacting against systems that are set up without their input.
I watched some of these Poetry Slams, Gabriel Cortez, some clips from them, and it was an interesting environment because it's both supportive but also competitive. And that's not an easy balance. So how do you cultivate that balance?
Yeah.
What do you tell the youth about
it? So when we've got spaces like Poetry Slams, which can feel so contradictory, right? Because we ask youth to come up on stage, share your truth, spit your poem.
And then it's scored.
And then it's scored, right? Right. I think one thing that I really appreciate about Youth Speaks is we try really hard to de-emphasize the competition. We're like, yo, it's a gimmick. We're just trying to get you in the door. We're just trying to get you to share your truths in a way. It's exciting for audience members. But when we're backstage and we're preparing folks to get up on stage, I think of folks like one of my mentors who used to work for Youth Speaks, Dennis Kim, and the way that he contextualizes us getting up on stage is this is an altar. This is a space of sacrifice, right, where we're sharing our stories for the audience, but it's also a space where change can possibly happen. He makes it a play on words, not only the altar in, right, this is where we leave sacrifice, but altar as in we can alter reality here. And that's ultimately the purpose of when we're having young folks get up on stage, like James was talking about. There's potential for a community to be built here, backstage and with folks that hear your piece, that want to have a conversation with you afterwards, that maybe felt like, oh, I thought this was just my story, right? And so that's what we try to emphasize before the competition thing.
And can I add one thing to it, too? I just want to say real quick that it is competitive and we try our best to make fun of it and whatever, but it's less competitive actually than the publishing world, and which is also, you send in poems to magazines or whatever and they get buried under slush piles. At least at the slam, there's ridiculous judging, but at least everybody gets a chance to be heard.
What are, just really quickly before I go to calls, what are the judges looking for? Do you know, like, what the criteria are?
Yeah, so whenever I'm priming judges to get ready to do their thing, I encourage them to look for, you know, what did you think of the writing? What did you think of the performance of the piece? What did you think of the content? You know, did it feel like it was coming from an urgent place? Did it ultimately move you? And that's one of the things with Poetry Slam. It's totally subjective. You know, sometimes you'll have a judge that comes in and this is their first poem they've ever heard in their life. And that's cool. You know, sometimes we've got folks that have published 10 books and that's okay too. And sometimes folks will judge a poem based on how terrible the sandwich they had this morning was. And that's fine. That's why I encourage, like, the young folks, like, let the scores go in one ear, out the other, but ultimately be your own compass when it comes to what your personal excellence is, and let that guide you. You know when you got off stage if you did the work.
Well, Antoine writes, I just tuned in and caught the poem read. Awesome. I could see her vision of Oakland while listening. Awesome. And there were 4 exclamation marks. Let's go to calls. Gabriel in Dallas. Hi, Gabriel.
Yes, good morning. Gracias and felicitaciones a estos muchachos. I grew up in the 60s in Texas, and my question to these young people, did the history that was being taught in the books relate? How did they relate with them? Most of my schoolmates could not relate to the constitutions and the forefathers and so on and so on, because there was not many Hispanics. And in Texas, we were not allowed to speak Spanish. We were not allowed to congregate as far as being Latinos. And in their poems, I feel and hear the same cry and the same feelings of hurt in trying to identify as to where we are in this country. You know, the books have to be changed. The truth has to be told. You know, the treaties have to come out. And politically, you know, the only person that I think is being a Democrat, Hillary Clinton, is the one that's going to make us come out of this whole problem.
Well, Gabriel, let me get our young people to respond to the point you were making about whether or not they connect with the history that's being taught to them in history books. Tamia Romo, do you want to take that?
I'll definitely take that. For so long, this country has a history of silencing marginalized groups, whether it be in their history books and their art forms. There's been a huge attempt to silence many groups, and so I feel like now, by myself speaking about it as an Afro-Latina, it's an act of resistance and it's an act of rebellion, and it's this huge deal, because for so long my people have held on to the silence and have been suffocated by the silence. And so it's definitely a process for me to think about that now me being present right now is this huge political statement, even though at the time it might not seem so political to me. That my existence is incredibly political.
Wow. Well, Gabriel, thank you for the call.
By 2042, the minorities, meaning Latinos and African Americans, are going to be the majority. And if we do not change the books, we do not tell the story right and set the record straight, you know, people are going to revolt. People are going to say, enough is enough.
Well, Gabriel, thanks for calling in. And again, that number to call is 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Let's go to Mia in Oakland. Hi, Mia.
Hi, how's it going?
Great. Go ahead.
So I'm calling in because I've been so frustrated and ashamed every time I hear these sound bites attributed to people my age, 27, a quote-unquote millennial, that sound so scattered and upbeaty, and I was struck from just the first sentences that both of your guests uttered on air, and it gave me so much happiness to hear you representing us so beautifully, and I just wanted to say thank you.
Well, Mia, thank you so much for the call.
Thank you. Kathy
tweets, what talent. Thank you. And Boris asks, are there any collaborations between Youth Speaks and Youth Radio? Both groups give young people a powerful voice. James Cass.
Yeah, we've been working with Youth Radio forever, and we've done work with them as well as we partner with lots of different organizations and lots of different programs. And the Center for Investigative Reporting we work with, and we work with the California Diabetes Project and the Center for Vulnerable Populations. We're trying as much as possible to move young people into the center of really critical conversations. So we're working with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and KQED on a project around the high school dropout crisis. We have all different kinds of stuff going on. For us, it's, and we have a project around mass incarceration. For us, it's really critical to partner with as many agencies as possible to make as visible as possible as many voices as possible and to prepare young people to be ready for those moments. Because I want to pick up on something Gabriel said about we need new books before he signed off. Part of our work has been about creating a counter-narrative or a series of counter-narratives to the dominant narrative that's out there, that is defining who and what America is or should be, that there's multiple stories that have been, to Tamia's point, silence. And for the counter-narrative piece for us is really, really critical, the creation of new canon, right? So we publish books. We publish young poetry specifically so it's there beyond just the moment of live inspiration. Because for us, that's really critical to redefine and expand the narrative of just who people are and just who this country is.
Yeah, you know, that reminds me, Gabriel, you provided us with a clip about a D.C. group poem. This was during a performance at the Brave New Voices International Poetry Festival in 2014. Could you describe what we're about to hear here from this group and sort of how they're countering the narrative?
Absolutely. So what you're going to hear is four poets. They're representing D.C. in the 2014 Brave New Voices International Youth Poetry Festival. And the poem is called Waters, and they're talking about their experience as Black Americans dealing with history of stereotypes when it comes to Black folks and water, dealing with our relationship historically, and also like on a mythological level and on a personal level. So what I love about this piece is how they weave a lot of different kind of points of entry together into this poem and make something really beautiful.
And you worked with this group to create this poem?
I wish I worked with this group to create this poem. I didn't work with them directly, but I have used this poem in classes that I've facilitated as an example of what's the potential for poetry and group pieces in particular and multiple voices coming together.
All right. Well, let's hear this performance from Brave New Voices, the International Poetry Festival in 2014.
Under the sea, under the sea.
Wading in the water are the bones of our sons and daughters.
On high tide, skeletons skate onto shores.
At young, we're taught the rules.
Run when it rains.
Cover your head.
Black bodies have always known struggle when it comes to
water. And textbooks won't dare to whisper how slave masters ensured that their never learned to swim.
To freedom.
Myrtle Beach currents tried to capsize my sister.
In the cemetery disguised as an oceanic playground.
I was the middle passage between ashes and holiness.
An oil spill of our family polluted the water.
My sister's keeper, sacrificed my breath to keep her afloat.
He sank to the bottom to raise me.
But something raised me. Palms on the soles of our feet.
Ancestral ghosts wouldn't allow the sea to swallow us whole.
Again.
After Yemaya, African goddess of water, gave birth to the 14 Orishas, her water breaking caused the great flood that created the ocean. After my own mother's water broke, she named me Morgan. It means of the sea.
Underwater is where she hoped I'd learn to
free. But when my father told me the truth of my conception, that they drowned themselves in liquor on homecoming night, it was then that I realized I was gifted this name so that I'd never have to know what sinking felt like.
In the fifth grade, swim class was a gym requirement. My predominantly white classmates gathered around the edge of the pool. They wanted to watch as I disproved the myth that there was no buoyancy in Black boys. I saw the congregation of hazy white ghosts gleam down at me.
Felt my skin tighten and twist.
In 1964, a white hotel manager poured acid into a pool in which Blacks were staging the St. Augustine swimming.
Wonder how tight this skin got.
History will gossip of Black bodies paving ocean floors like drowning family trees.
This is why waves taste like tears.
This is why oceans are salted.
Black bodies have always known pain when it comes to water.
I press my ear to an abandoned skull. Hear the thoughts of the woman who used to live inside of it.
The struggle screams.
They tried to tell me it was the sound of the ocean.
I was holding a conch,
but they didn't know.
Yemaya's first gift to humans was a seashell in which her voice could always be heard, a reminder that
whether slave ships, fire hoses, levees, tears, black bodies have always known rebirth when it comes to water.
At young, we're taught the rules of float or flight.
When it rained, we never ran, we stood.
We covered our heads not in fear,
but in prayer.
We have always been the middle passage between ashes and holiness.
What is the graveyard at our feet?
Or our Savior's faith walking on water.
No bullets, no fists, no chains, no whips can hurt an ocean. We are children of the sea. Underwater is where we have always learned to.
Up on the shore, they work all day. Out in the sun, they slave away. While we devoting full time to floating. Under the sea.
That was a performance at the Brave New Voices International Poetry Festival in 2014. And Gabriel Cortez, our guest, uses that poem as an example to educate the youth poets that he mentors. Gabriel Cortez, one of the things that strikes me about that, besides just how powerful and intense it is that it's a group all doing this together. How does that change the process?
Yeah, so that's one of the things that excites me in particular about this medium in which we operate, going back to the orality of voice, right? And this is one way that spoken word poetry has the potential to differentiate between just poems you'd see on the page. Multiple voices can't exist in the same way. They can't overlap each other. They can't speak back and forth to each other. You can't sing on the page in the same way that you can in a live performance. And so when you're creating pieces like this, whenever I'm scaffolding that process, maybe we'd start with the individual story, right? We'd start with the word palette. You know, when you think water, what do you think of, right? What's your relationship to water? And this is where the personal stories come out. This is where maybe someone makes the connection to history. And then the work of weaving them together, that's, you know, the editing process where we try to squish our stories together and see if there is a through line, a thread connecting it all together. And I think, that's an exciting and powerful part of the work that we're doing, ultimately coming back to making safe space for communities to exist and for folks to make those bridges between each other's stories.
Yeah, and the connections between them, I imagine, in terms of their relationships to each other must mm-hmm. also be intensified and strengthened. Chaz tweets, "Poetry helped me understand how to view words as art beyond their literal meaning and how to speak in metaphors and analogies." Poetry for poetry's sake seems like it would be hard to get funding for. A listener asked, does James Cass find he has to sell the skills that kids gain to get funding for Youth Speaks?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I will say when I started the organization, that was, you know, people told me it's a great idea. There's no money in poetry, so good luck. And I have a poem about that. But but actually, I don't think... The answer is yes, but that's not the way I think about it. Like, we don't sell skills. And, you know, what we do is we really contextualize what poetry has come to mean for an entire generation, that it's no longer about form and waiting for the muse to come down from the heavens and sit on your shoulders and whispers in your ear. It's about young people really being able to redefine the art form. And we're not just a poetry organization or a spoken word organization, so we think about it as writing, but it allows young people to redefine the process of putting pen to paper, putting mouth to microphone, and using it both in an individual and a group context to hopefully shift the world and make the world a little bit more just. That's ultimately what it is about.
Well, let's go to more calls. And again, that number is 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Tom in San Jose. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Yeah, about 4 or 5 years ago, my daughter was part of the student groups at SF Jazz, and she was invited to participate at an event at this pirate store in the Mission that had a youth poets there. I don't know if it was Youth Speaks or not, but
it was
this great event. And I think you've got some more stuff, more collaboration with SF Jazz. But I wanted you to talk about, you know, that in particular, but also more generally how you incorporate music in your programming, or a distinction between music and poetry in a sort of a larger sense.
Tom, thanks.
I think Tamia, you guys, you should talk about this. I will say we have done some collaborations. We're doing something with SF Jazz right now, in fact, with some of the state poet laureates as well. And so for us, it's great to expose young people to the variety of art forms that they can participate in, and sort of also young people who are musicians with young people who are poets, and just give them the space to do it as they want to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think this medium offers a lot of space to include music and include whatever you want to bring into it. It's a very open space. If you want to sing in your piece, or if you want to have someone play the drums lightly in your piece, you can have all of that. It's a very open space, and it's very malleable. You can definitely include whatever you like.
You know, you started the day off by asking, what is a safe space? Well, one of the things that we did brilliantly from the beginning that we've continued to do is we've brought a DJ into all of our live poetry readings, and we did that from the early days. And some of that was because many of us grew up as sort of hip-hop kids, but it's just helped us reset the space, and it sort of incorporates interesting music, and the DJ plays an equal role to the poets in sort of making the night happen, and the poetry is infused by music throughout the night, and the crowd is fun. It's like, for us, it's a party. Like, poetry should be a party. Mm-hmm. And like, we throw poetry parties. That's what we do.
Well, let's go to Charles in San Jose. Hi, Charles.
A very beautiful morning to you and all of your guests. I am overwhelmed by what I have just had the privilege of hearing. I want to first of all say thank you to the two individuals who read, first of all, Gold Tooth. Even though I came into the program, I missed most of it, but I heard the last of it. And my dear brother, God bless you for that.
Thank you. Dear
sister, God bless you for your poem on Oakland. I'm a 67-year-old African-American male who born and raised in Columbus, Ohio, but spent 20 years in Oakland. And I love the city myself, my sister. I think it's wonderful. Mm-hmm. I want to say to you that I am a Christian man, and you young people have given me again affirmation to the fact that God is alive in all the artistry that you've just shared with us all. And I'd like to know again, is the Davies Hall event? I hope it's not sold out, because I plan to be there.
James Cass, it's April 16th, and it's free.
Saturday? No, it's not free.
Okay.
Thank you, though. But it's cheap. It's $5 for youth, $10 for adults, and there are still tickets on sale. You can go to youspeaks.org and get all the information. Saturday, April 16th, it's the Grand Slam Finals of the 20th annual You Speaks Teen Poetry Slam. Mm-hmm.
Well, Charles, thanks so much for calling in. And another listener wants to know, what poets do Gabriel and Tamia like? Who has influenced them?
Oh, man.
Gabriel Cortez?
I love this question, because this is going to be my first tweet for hashtag National Poetry Month. Who are your top five favorite poets? Right now, I've been listening to and reading a lot of Saul Williams, Mark Bamuthi Joseph, Sherman Alexie. I've been loving Lucille Clifton, some of my contemporaries like Denez Smith, Jamila Woods, Ariana Brown, talking about Afro-Latino identity. Those are some folks that I really look up to. And yeah, I
can go on. I can see that. Tamia Romo, who comes to mind?
I share many of the same favorite poets. Ariana Brown, Denez Smith, Andrea Gibson has played a huge role in my poetry and in my life. Lucille Clifton. So many poets come to mind. It's a little overwhelming. Pages Matam. Oh, God. So many.
Tamia Romo, I read that your family hasn't yet come to your performances. Is that true, or have they started to?
My family has not come to my performances yet. They have. It's a very sacred place to me, and I don't. It's interesting that sometimes it's easier to admit or say things in front of people that you don't know too well, or strangers, as one might say, than your family. And it's, from my experience, I felt a lot more comfortable and a lot more safe in those environments, saying my poetry and saying my truths and within my own personal bio family, because there's your chosen family, and then there's your family, and your family can be part of your chosen family, or you can have a whole new chosen family.
And that's okay with you, right? I mean, it sounds like they're supportive of it,
Completely.
And it's allowing you to be able to express what you want to say, and that there will be a point when you feel like it's time.
There will definitely. But for now, I have my chosen family to back me up.
Yeah. Cheryl in Castro Valley. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. I just want to say I was absolutely blown away by the poetry of these two young people. It was powerful. It was real. And I am so grateful that a place, an organization was founded and doing well, allowing young people to speak their truth. It is so very important. And God bless and bring many blessings upon all of you.
Well, Cheryl, thanks so much for the call. And Gabriel Cortez, thanks so much for being here. Poet mentor with Youth Speaks.
Of course. So excited to be here. Thanks again.
And thanks also to Tamia Romo. She is a poet and member of Spokes, the student advisory board of Youth Speaks. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
And James Cass, founder and executive director of Youth Speaks. Youth Speaks has its slam semifinals tomorrow, right?
They start Friday, yeah, tomorrow.
And
or tonight.
Tonight. Oh, tonight. I have it April 2nd down, actually. And then your big Youth Speaks Grand Slam final is April 16th at Davies Symphony Hall.
Yeah, we look forward to seeing there. If you want to know what the future of this country is talking about, come to a Youth Speaks event.
And thank you to our listeners for sharing their thoughts and responses to the poetry we heard today. Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, Judy Campbell, and Mel Baker. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Font. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Joanne Wallace is our executive producer. Our interns are Eli Wolf and Ida Mojadad. I'm Mina Kim. Have a great weekend.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.